a last case of today, and I thank you for waiting. It's number 20-1753, Wartloff v. the Milton Hershey School and School Trust, Mr. Cirillo and Mr. Handelman. Mr. Cirillo?
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. I guess it's now good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. May it please the court, my name is Greg Cirillo, and I'm privileged to represent the estate of Abby Bartels and her family. I will tell you that if there's ever a case where summary judgment's improper, this is the case. The district court ignored over 4 years of written discovery, 42 depositions, and expert depositions, which have already taken place, and then they say there's no issues in material fact. I tell you, this case is about that. The district court just punted, and they base it on three simple points. I'll say them, and then I'll address them sequentially. The first point that the court did is they dismissed the FHA claim, and they said that Abby Bartels had no standing, and she couldn't be discriminated against because she didn't pay monetary tuition, and they determined that her work chores were gratuitous. The second thing they did was they dismissed the negligence claims, and therefore the wrongful death claims and survival claims that arise out of that, because they did a bright line rule and said, hey, as long as Abby Bartels is off campus, then Milton Hershey School couldn't be responsible for her foreseeable suicide. The third thing they did is they dismissed the intentional infliction of emotional distress count, where we can prove that their conduct was outrageous so that we should get punitive damages, because they actually barred an enrolled student from coming back to the Milton Hershey School without ever doing an assessment. And I'll get to that. What I'd like to do first is talk about the FHA claim and then briefly the other two.
Yeah, I mean, what you've got here with the Milton Hershey School is something that is unique.
Correct.
With respect to boarding schools, it's all free. No one's paying. You're not paying for tuition. You're not paying for your room. It is 100% free. The only thing is you do sign a contract that Correct. Says that, you know, you'll abide by the rules, and those rules include doing certain chores. But is that a quid pro quo or a voluntary bargain for exchange for rent, for actually renting a room?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked. That's a great question. Actually, it's bargained for, because you can't go to the Milton Hershey School unless you agree to the terms that are in the enrollment agreement.
Does the enrollment agreement make attending the school dependent on the chores? What provision does? What provision of the agreement? Where?
Your Honor, it's in the enrollment agreement that you have to do certain things, and chores is one of them. I mean,
okay,
I don't have
you don't know what provision in there.
Right. I don't have that in front
okay.
of me.
Okay. Well, yeah. If I had someone from church, his house got flooded, he comes over to stay with me for a few days, I say, yeah, okay, you can stay on my couch. How about you wash the dishes or something? Does the fact that I ask him to wash the dishes and he does that make him a renter?
No, I'd say that's basically a temporary stay. The issue in this case, though, is this is permanent housing. She's been there for 9 years, from 2004 to.
All right, let's say someone's house is flooded. It's going to take 4 months to rebuild it. And I say, okay, wash the dishes and vacuum up and sweep. Does that make the person a renter?
It might. That's the sliding scale of the sufficiency of the consideration. The issue is what is the sufficiency of the consideration?
In common parlance, would anyone call someone a renter if you just gratuitously let them stay and say, hey, just out of kindness, politeness, whatever else, do some chores?
That might not be gratuitous, though. That's what I'd say, Your Honor. It might be bargained for, because I might go somewhere else where I could stay gratuitously and do nothing. This is actually, and this is even stronger than the.
So you're going to tell us then that the Fair Housing Act is going to reach a whole bunch of stuff that isn't in common parlance called renting, just because you squinted it hard enough and maybe you could make it look like a peppercorn of consideration.
Well, I think that it's clear that it can be. I mean, it is you're giving housing, and you don't have to be a renter or buyer by paying monetary consideration under 3604, I believe it is. F1, that there are other, and we cite cases that. I'll tell you what's interesting, though, Your Honor, and we do cite cases that monetary consideration is not required. The great question would be is, we cited the Fourier's case where they say you don't need monetary consideration and you can have other things, but they send it back by, they never get to the chore issue or the consideration. These are factual issues though, that would go to a jury. Why you don't see it? I mean, we search, and the great question to me would be, where's your main case that would say that? It never comes up because you don't usually have a death. It doesn't come up because you have an ADA claim. But in our case, you can't have an ADA claim because Abby Bartels is deceased. So it's not an ADA claim. It becomes the fair housing and actually the DOJ.
Yeah, but this is a charity. This is a charity. It's got a ton of money. It's doing these things for free for the poorest. The terms of the gift require everything be for free. Why should we treat this in the bargained for basket rather than in the charitable, you know, gift basket?
Well, because it's not a gift. You have to abide by the requirements. Then you asked me about provisions.
Your dad says he's going to give you a Porsche when you turn 16, but you got to go take the driving test. You got to abide by the requirement, but no one would call that a quid pro quo exchange. It's a condition.
No, but actually consideration would have to be a benefit to the promisor, which would be the Milton Hershey School, and a detriment to the promisee, which would be Abby Bartels. For instance, I'll give you the perfect example. What it is suppose these people were children, right? I mean, suppose these people were adults. You'd have to pay for services of the chores we listed, of vacuuming, cutting the grass, setting the table, making the bed, cleaning the apartment. They would be paid for. You have to have a benefit and you have to have a detriment.
That's also true in all the hypos I've given you. Someone else is going to have to wash your dishes. Someone else, maybe the dad makes the son shovel out the driveway. And yet that's not enough to say that the son is suddenly giving the dad consideration for the Porsche.
You're right. That's the point, actually. The point is, what is sufficiency of consideration to get to a jury? This is a summary judgment case. The judge makes that finding, and we say he made an incorrect finding. Look at the opinion. In the opinion, they use a tramp analogy, Your Honor. They use a tramp analogy, saying if a pimp gives a prostitute some money to go up the street and buy a coat, they say that's gratuitous. Well, that's because there's no direct benefit and a detriment. That's a gratuity, just like your Porsche analogy. That's the best analogy they came up with. That's not even apropos.
Can I give a better, a related question on the FHA? Was the graduation ceremony a service that was offered in connection with the student housing, or was it a service offered in connection with the school?
Well, that's a service in connection with the school, but I think you're getting to the next issue that'll become. When you get to the negligence claims, like I said, this is a pretty simple case. There's three claims or 3 points they decided it on. We say by denying her to get to that graduation, coming back to the ceremony was what pushed her over the edge and caused her suicide. Now, we might be wrong or we might be right. That's our position. We have no fewer than 3 experts that will testify to that. We might be wrong, we might be right, but that's a factual issue that has to go to the jury.
There has to be a duty before a negligence claim goes to the jury. It doesn't matter if there's causation, if there's no duty.
Right. You need a duty, you need breach, you need causation. You need
okay, damage. What case is remotely close to this in establishing a duty? A duty to continue maintaining care after she's released?
Okay, that's a great question. You know, the thing is, that's our position. You're getting to the next thing. There's 2 hospitalizations here, Your Honor, as you know. There's a Philhaven, she's there from May 28th to June 5th. While she's at Philhaven, she's actually actively being treated by Dr. Herr, who holds at lab 5, we have the medical records, 5 treatment sessions while she's off campus, not in loco parentis. Then she has a second hospitalization from June 11th to June 19th of 2013. They released her because Milton Hershey School, within 24 hours of her going into that second hospitalization, that's what they tried to do. That's the district court bought into that. They said, well, there's no duty. She's off campus. We say they were negligent. They can't dispute that on the other side. She's a fully enrolled student that Dr. Syed, who's a psychiatrist at PPI, said she could have been released back to the Milton Hershey School where she was enrolled. She had her housing, her clothes were there. They cut her off as soon as she went into that second hospitalization. They said she's not coming back. And that decision was made by home life administrators, not even by their medical staff, within 24 hours of her being admitted to PPI, Pennsylvania Psychiatric.
What's the last day of the spring term?
I think the last term, when it was, say, the 19th, she got out. She's still an enrolled student. I imagine it was probably the 21st or 2nd after the graduation took place. But what Milton Hershey School does in this situation, since we're getting into facts, and again, that's the thing, these are all factual issues. Would Milton, they offer a year-round program?
What duty do they have to have her back to campus? What duty requires bringing her back?
She's enrolled, she's a student there.
What duty prevents them from terminating that status?
Okay, their own policies and procedures say you can't terminate somebody without following their own policies and procedures. They never made an assessment. In fact, I'll tell you, if you go to my brief on page 18, this is the sneaky part of where they cut themselves off. They actually booted her off campus when she could have come back. And they actually do that without making an assessment. On page 18 of my brief, and I want to read it to you because I took that deposition by videotape. I said, in direct contradiction to an erroneous finding of the district court, Milton Hershey School never did any sort of assessment. They booted her out to try to get rid of the duty. About whether Abby's abandoned her treatment and about whether they can meet Abby's needs, and they cut her off. If you turn to page 19 of my brief, I asked the questions, and I put it word for word in there, word for word. I said, turning to target goals, these are their own policies and procedures. I said, on June 14, 2013, turning to target goals on page 2, target goals.
Wait a second.
If Milton Hershey School was able to meet her high level mental needs, you see that? Yes.
And then okay,
yes.
You're claiming this is not an in loco parentis duty. This is something separate as a continuous duty of care, right? That's your argument.
Wait. Let me be clear about that. They have an in loco parentis duty because she's in their care, custody, and control, and they're in the residence. But they also have other duties when she's off campus. You can't cut somebody
those other duties.
It's in our complaint. It's all about.
I'm sorry, sir. The way this works is I ask some questions you answer. Okay. When you're the judge, we'll do it differently. The district court found that you hadn't raised these other duties until the summary judgment, and therefore you had forfeited those arguments.
Not true.
Okay. So the district judge is mistaken in its reading of the record at App 29, Note 6.
Yep, absolutely.
Please cite the places in the record earlier where you preserve this, say at the complaint stage.
Yeah, if you look at our complaint, we do that in our reply brief. We cite all those things about their duties of care. Our main argument is how they treated her when she was off campus. In our complaint, that's all it talks. When she was abandoned, she was cut off from treatment. That's the negligence part. When she's not in there, is how they treated her when she was off campus. That's why we cite that in our reply brief. And I'm sorry I interrupted you earlier, but that's the exact point I foresaw your question that I was trying to get to. That's been from day one. It's been in our reports. It's in our expert reports. They've taken expert discovery on that.
Your friend, though, at pages 43 to 46 in his brief says, you know, none of those paragraphs makes a claim of continuing duty of care. There's nowhere in the amended complaint that uses a phrase like continuity of care. All the stuff, I mean, Special Appendix 21 said expressly loco parentis. So what was there that focused the district court's attention on continuity of care? Where in the complaint?
Well, I think in our complaint, and I think if you go to, you know, I have that in the reply brief. I'll tell you the pages. I don't have the reply brief in front of me, but the amended complaint in front of me, because it is an amended complaint.
If you don't have it handy, you can tell us on rebuttal. Yeah.
I have it. It's on page 10 of our reply brief where we cite everything we said about their continuing duty and how they abandoned her and cut her off from treatment.
All right.
Was off campus.
What's the earliest in the record? You have a complaint citation or something?
Yeah, I think it's A641 to A644 in the record, and that's the amended complaint.
All right, but you don't have a paragraph in the complaint. Citing the whole complaint.
I think paragraph 188 talks about...
We'll hear from your friend what he thinks about paragraph 188.
Yeah, one administrative question, Mr. Cirillo. How much time do you wish to reserve for rebuttal?
Two minutes.
Okay. I want to ask you something about the negligence claim, but before I get into it, Judge Roth, did you have any questions?
No, I don't.
Okay. On the negligence claim, ordinarily in loco parentis duty is coextensive with physical custody. So why should the school's duty extend beyond that when the school has no control over what happens to the students once they leave the school's custody, and in this case, go to the parents? In other words, you're asking us to draw a line that I don't see.
Yeah, well, here's the issue. I mean, she's a fully enrolled student. And when and Judge Bibas asked that question, which was a good question. She's a fully enrolled student. There were several days left in the school year, including her graduation and her graduation ceremony.
She was a fully enrolled student with a very significant issue that required two hospitalizations, unfortunately. And the school, you know, did send its person over for the first hospitalization, what you said, five times, or to talk with her. Is that correct?
Correct. I believe it was about five.
And the second hospitalization, how many times was that?
That's the point. They cut her off. They never did it again. Once robotically, that's in our briefs too. There's a policy where somebody goes in a second time, they boot somebody out.
Looking at life from 10,000 feet.
Correct.
It would seem that the one thing you want a school to do when a person is having issues, psychological issues in this case, is to put that person in the custody of somebody who really knows what they're doing. And the hospital, she's in a unit there that deals with these types of situations. Later on, they send her home to her parents, and as it turns out, she didn't take her medication and the parents didn't insist on it. And it's kind of hard from 10,000 feet to say, okay, that's like doubly removed for a school to be held liable for negligence when they did exactly what they're supposed to do. They got the professionals involved. And then when they were told it was okay, they let her go home with her parents, who were supposed to make sure that she took the medications that were prescribed.
Well, look, there's no evidence that not taking medication in a short period of time is what caused her to commit suicide. There's no evidence that. What I will tell you, Your Honor, is I agree that what you do is you send somebody to an outside facility. But look at the dates. I'll give them to you again. It's June 11th to June 19th. Within 24 hours, they said by Home Life Administrators, Heather Teeter or Mick Stewart, they said she's not coming back. And then nobody made a determination whether they could meet her needs. When she was to let go home, the only reason she went home was because and that's in our brief too, they said she's not coming back. They didn't let her back on campus. She was very
well. When she was released from the hospital, did the hospital say she needs to go back to Milton Hershey? What was their release plan?
Absolutely. You know, when we took her the deposition of Dr. Syed from PPI said there's no reason why she couldn't have gone back to the Milton Hershey School. The only reason they discharged her home was because the Milton Hershey School got in touch with PPI and says, we don't want her back.
Did they have any objection to did PPI have any objection to discharging her home?
They didn't know that. They just were told.
That it was improper in any way to discharge her to go home?
No, they just discharged her in accordance with the instructions from the Milton Hershey School, since they said she's not coming back. She's going to be going home. They were going to
put her home. But you're saying there was Milton Hershey School that told PPI
yes.
when to discharge her and how to discharge her? I find that very hard.
They didn't tell her when to discharge her. They told her when she's discharged, though, she ain't coming back here.
Okay, and so they found it perfectly medically acceptable to discharge her to her parents.
They did that with the transition plan because they were told she was going to go home and you should do the discharge plan for home and not coming back to the Milton Hershey School. See, that's, you know, it's interesting you raise it. I think that's why in their history they booted her out because she suffered from a disability like depression. They booted
her
out.
To treat at Milton Hershey School.
No, they actually brag about in their white paper how they have 43 licensed psychologists.
Mr. Cirillo.
And a health facility.
Mr. Cirillo.
Yes.
Let's say a student breaks his arm at Milton Hershey School.
Correct.
School drives the student to the hospital. Student's Correct. Parents check him into the emergency room.
Correct.
The hospital says, okay, we've dealt with the arm. It was broken. We put it in a cast. If there are surgical mistakes, that's not the hospital's, the school's responsibility, right?
Right. We're not saying there's.
If the doctors mistreat the arm, that's not right. You're not saying that. Let's say they discharge the student and they say, look, this kind of wound needs to be bathed regularly in an antibiotic solution, or else the person might get infected. And let's say the school is aware that the parents are disorganized. Would your position be that the school is liable if it doesn't arrange to keep bathing her arm because there's some concerns about whether the arm will get bathed properly at home by the parents?
No, and by the way, that's a completely different situation, Your Honor. In this situation, since you raise it about the parents and the disorganized, the father is an alcoholic, third time was going to jail. The mother's a junkie, no question about that. And what happened, this was a year like no others. Don't forget, Abby Bartels was there for 9 years. This particular summer, that the stepmother, Karen Fitzpatrick, was going to kick the father out of the house. The mother and the father was going to go to prison. The biggest stress in the medical records of Dr. Herr were that the stress in her life was coming from her family. Milton Hershey School knew that that was the biggest stress in her life, and they told PPI she's not coming back. So she gets discharged to the worst situation. That's, and we have experts who say that was a foreseeable suicide. That's what pushed her over the top. Deposition testimony told that she.
So that's a causation issue, but what makes it a duty on Milton Hershey in the first place to be responsible if there's a chaotic situation at home?
Well, they're not responsible for that, but they didn't have, what they should have done was discharge her back to the Milton Hershey School.
So then why is the arm analogy not right? Why wouldn't the Milton Hershey School be responsible for making sure there's proper wound care and bathing because the kid has a chaotic home life where the wound may not get antibiotic ointment? How are you not opening that can of worms?
I don't think we are. I mean, that's a completely different situation for when you discharge somebody home and say, make sure you go get them medical. We're not saying this is a medical malpractice case or anything like that. Or we're saying it's a school negligence case for not letting an enrolled student come back. They completely, it's their own conduct. They completely abandon her and cut her off the second time, which they didn't do the first time. And I think that's why you've never seen.
But in essence, you're imposing an obligation on them not to expel her.
Well, they'll actually do that. They'll call it a long-term leave of, I don't care what you call it.
Whatever you call it, long-term leave of absence.
Long-term termination, barring her from campus.
You're in essence putting a duty on them not to put her on a long-term leave of absence.
Well.
Where does that duty come from?
Well, I'll tell you, they made that decision within 24 hours of her being admitted.
What's your best authority that says that a school has an obligation not to put a student on long-term leave of absence, suspension, expulsion, something analogous.
Sure. Well, common sense-wise.
Authority.
Well, their own policies and procedures.
Okay, cite me. What is it that binds them and creates a tort duty based on a contract?
Well, their own contract and their own.
Okay, cite it to me.
The white paper. I don't have the entire white
paper. Maybe by rebuttal you can come up with a citation.
But let me just finish the train of thought on that. Their own duties, they have to follow certain policies and procedures before they would boot an enrolled student out. That's what's so important. The duty's created because she's still their student. That's still where she resides. That's still her housing.
All right. Thank you. We'll get you back on rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
We've had Jeff for about over 21 minutes.
Okay.
And we'll go to Mr. Handelman and pick up from there.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jared Handelman, and I represent the appellees in this appeal to Milton Hershey School and the Hershey Trust Company. Judge Jones's opinion granting summary judgment in favor of the appellees ended where I think it is appropriate for us to begin, recognizing that the death of Abrielle Bartels is undeniably tragic and manifestly heartbreaking. However, the civil lawsuit that resulted that's now before this court on appeal was, as Judge Jones correctly observed, undergirded by certain factual assumptions that are not substantiated by this record.
Can I just go straight away to the
sure,
one thing more troubling to me than of the other issues, and that's the negligence claim. It makes sense for in loco parentis duty to be coextensive with physical custody in the general case, and certainly for public schools or day schools. But the Milton Hershey School is so fundamentally different from these other schools because it has a unique relationship with students that it does much good for. Here you've got facts that show that during the first hospitalization, somebody from the psychology unit at the school communicated with the Abby, at least five times. Then we don't know what happened, or at least I don't know what happened during the second hospitalization. And then they send her home, or have the hospital send her home, because they're not taking her back, knowing that there is great stress in her home life. I mean, significant stress, a spike that could be foreseen. Why isn't there some duty to say, okay, look, we got to keep you here until the smoke clears at home?
Well, Judge Ambrose, I would begin with taking at least some issue with the attempt to characterize the Milton Hershey School as unique compared to some of the other institutions that you
said. Well, they don't charge, right?
They don't charge, and you reside at the school during the school year. But that is not a distinct factual circumstance or presentation of an educational service like the ones they provide that is so different than any other residential school that it would somehow attach a duty to them that I don't think, and I agree with Judge Bibas's comments, simply not cognizable under any version of Pennsylvania or federal law that I am certainly aware of. The circumstance of a student's enrollment at the Milton Hershey School, there are a lot of resources there, but it's a school. It's not a mental health hospital. And what they do for children in order to accommodate their attendance of that school, despite suffering from some of these difficult issues, is laudable. It is not one that I think creates a duty that is otherwise not recognized by the law.
Mr. Hendelman, is your friend on the other side right that the second hospitalization ends before the end of the spring term, that June 19th, that the school was still going on for a few more days after that?
Your Honor, there were events, for example, the graduation ceremony, but I do not, and I cannot cite you to anything in the record because frankly, I'm not sure it's there, okay, to suggest that there were still classes, for example, being conducted at the school. The school year was in effect over, and the summer break was about to begin. And that seems to be a recognition that everybody makes in the timing of her discharge from PPI.
Okay, but there's still housing being provided for a few more days afterwards, right? And there's still this barbecue or cookout, I guess?
Well, there was a picnic, if you will, okay, and I know it takes on different names here.
And is the picnic one of the associated benefits that comes with housing? You live in this residence hall, you get to go to the picnic?
No, Your Honor. Let me jump to what I think your question addresses, which is the F2 side of the FHA claim, which for the first time, incidentally, I should point out to the panel, before this court, I have heard arguments about this F2 claim that I had never heard before. Nowhere in this lower court record or in any of my opponent's briefing has a facilities claim for a denial of access to a facility called Founders Hall, where allegedly this graduation ceremony occurred. And as I stand here today, I can't even tell you I know that to be true. I have never heard that articulation of the F2 claim prior to coming before this court, and certainly neither did Judge Jones. But to the extent I move to the substantive aspects of an F2 claim, even if you were to entertain it for the first time being raised here, neither of the events that form the basis of this F2 claim would otherwise the statutory construction argument. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, you froze for a moment, but you're back. That's fine.
Okay. So independent of that, I think, Judge Bibas, for two reasons, it does not present a cognizable F2 claim. Number one, as you point out, or as you ask, the picnic and the graduation at ceremony itself have no connection to the student dwelling. In other words, the ticket to access either of those events is not the fact of your residence in the student home. They would be attendant to all manner of other requirements relating to attendance at the school, not related to the student housing. So no would be my long answer, Your Honor. I don't think that picnic or the graduation have a sufficient connection to the student dwelling such that it would give rise to an F2 claim.
Can we talk just briefly about the F1 claim? What if a student couldn't physically perform chores? Would that student be barred from attending Milton Hershey School? Someone with a disability.
No,
how about a student who could physically but just refused to perform the chores?
If there was a refusal, Your Honor, again, and this is not clear from the record, certainly the record citations made by my opponents do not address that, but that would not result in an expulsion from the school or from the student home. Again, the performance of the chores, I think it's really important to note, and Judge Ambrose, you note the unique nature of the Milton Hershey School. Being a resident in a student home at the Milton Hershey School isn't just the place you live. It's not just a dorm room. It teaches you life skills that are part of a home life curriculum that's offered at the school. So the performance of chores, while to us you may hear that and think, oh, that's just a job you have to do, that's actually part of a really important component of the educational curriculum there. Just as important as math, social studies, or any other scholastic curriculum that they might offer. And so in the same vein that not performing the chores certainly cannot constitute consideration for the student housing, imagine the expansion of that definition that would be required to accept the plaintiff's position. If you didn't do your math homework, if you didn't do your social studies homework, those things that are expected of any student, regardless of the school you go to, cannot create some proprietary interest in the student dwelling you're provided by the school.
Let me go back. Go ahead, Judge.
When she returned from the first hospitalization, was not that the school was not in the position where it could treat the extent of her depression. At the end of the second hospitalization, was the school in a position to take her as a patient to receive whatever continuing care she needed at that time?
It was not, Judge Roth, and I'm glad you mentioned the first hospitalization vis-a-vis the second. I know that the foundational discrimination theory of this case is that there was some nefarious two-hospitalization policy. I would be remiss if I didn't point out that this record is absolutely devoid of any support for the existence of that. There's no documentary, testimonial, or statistical data that would support the existence of any such policy. So for that reason, even as a prima facie matter, I don't think we ever even enter the doors, so to speak, of the FHA. But they are different, and I'm glad that you asked, because that what they show is that the school undertook a clinical assessment of what was happening with Abrielle Bartels. That is not in contravention or dereliction of any duty they owed, but in fact is a fulfillment of it. And there is a difference between the first time she's hospitalized and the second. The first time is the first time that level of service, the highest level of service that any mental health a person receiving mental health services would need. That is the highest level of care. That was the first time she required it. When she was discharged to the school didn't reject her. The school didn't say you can't come back. The school tried to follow what was recommended by the first hospital. They took her back, and within 24 hours, her condition deteriorated again. On June 9th, she was expressing a desire to die on a 9 out of 10 scale. So she had been back at the school for approximately 24 hours and very quickly deteriorated. So what it also may show us is that when the first hospital said, I think it's best that she go back to the school because it has a nurturing environment, well, that turned out not to be the case, Your Honor. She deteriorated very quickly and immediately required the resumption of that level of service that was replicated in the first hospitalization. So the second time when she went, again, there's no dispute. No one has ever disputed, and certainly this record doesn't support it, that this level of care was required for her treatment. In fact, everybody acknowledges that it was. And so nothing nefarious about her admission to the second hospitalization. In fact, again, a fulfillment of the school's duty, not a dereliction of it. And I do take factual issue, Your Honor, with any suggestion that somehow the first time she was hospitalized, they went there 5 or 6 times, and then the second time they cut off all contact. That's not supported by the record. The first time, just to be clear, they didn't provide treatment of Abrielle Bartels at any stage of any hospitalization, nor could they. And I refer the court to the record at A130 to 143, which is the affidavit of Dr. Beth Shaw from the Milton Hershey School, who outlines very clearly the limitations of what MHS could and could not provide for this young girl or for any of its students. So the suggestion that they were somehow treating her at Philhaven is completely belied by this record. They kept in contact in order to try to be apprised of what was happening with her. That is no different than what they did at PPI. And when Mr. Cirillo says they made a decision within 24 hours of their hospitalization at PPI, they didn't make a decision. They simply communicated when asked what her status at the school was going to be. They candidly told PPI, I can't tell you that right now because we don't know how her treatment's going to go at PPI. We don't know what your recommendations will be for her aftercare. They never, Your Honors, and I take great issue with this. It is simply not supported by the record. The Milton Hershey School did not in any way dictate the decision that PPI made. Dr. Syed's testimony is clear. People at PPI make those decisions, and they do it independent of any judgment that's expressed to them or opinion by any outside provider. They made the decision.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. If we were to conclude that the school had a duty to Abrielle during her hospitalization, Secklin, what would your argument be then? In other words, on the negligence claim.
Well, Your Honor, my argument would remain the same, that any duty they had was discharged and fulfilled by virtue of ensuring that she received the level of care that she required by her admission to PPI. And again, this goes back to the issue, Judge Ambrose, of whether or not we had seen this continuing care duty raised by the plaintiffs. We certainly hadn't. Again, it is being articulated for the first time in response to summary judgment, which is why Judge Jones correctly determined that it had been waived. And it's expounded upon even now before this court in ways that we had never seen. I submit, Judge Ambrose, that the conclusion by Judge Jones that the waiver of that argument was made or accomplished by plaintiff's failure to raise it is consistent with your opinion in Warfield, where you are not permitted to raise arguments in defense of summary judgment that have not otherwise been prosecuted or supported by the record prior to that. So my response, Judge Ambrose, to your question would be, there is no duty, there can't be any duty to her that somehow reattaches for some nebulous reason, frankly, one that I'm not even able to identify, after they take the appropriate step to place her in the care of an institution that is capable of meeting her needs. I think you, Judge Ambrose, said it was twice removed. I would suggest to you that the Milton Hershey School, by the time of this young girl's death, is thrice removed from any duty. They had placed her at PPI, and PPI had made the decision independent of them, as would be their obligations as doctors to their patient, to discharge her to the custody of her parents, who then assumed that responsibility in tandem with the formulation of a discharge plan that the Milton Hershey School didn't even know about.
Yes and no, because if the school year wasn't over after the first hospitalization, she went back to the school. And if the school year wasn't over after the second hospitalization, one would think that she would go back to the school there as well for the last few days.
Well, I respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with that. I don't think whether or not the school was in session speaks to the duty issue. Again, their responsibility is to make a judgment about whether or not they can meet her needs. The clinical judgments they rendered in this case are uncontradicted by anybody. I don't think Mr. Cirillo's expert reports have any relevance to summary judgment whatsoever.
What if Mr. Cirillo were to show a pattern in practice of one and done? Once a student is hospitalized once, the second time, you're out of there.
Well, there is no such pattern. I mean, if he did that, we would be in a different case, because there's absolutely no evidence that the two hospitalization rule, which is the foundation of their case, has any support in this record. And by the way, this was not a fleeting chance to prove it. We have 4+ years of discovery. We are not able, they were not able to identify any other student, let alone it should be, according to their theory, every student who was hospitalized in an outside mental health facility two or more times, according to their theory, would be robotically expelled from the campus. There's some statistical data in the record, Your Honor, from an interrogatory response that we provided that showed even in a finite period of time that they evaluated to find that evidence that you're talking about, some pattern, that in fact, nearly 63% of the students who were hospitalized two or more times were never terminated from the school. And that, of course, ignores the fact that their case is also built on the premise that Abrielle Bartels was terminated from the school, and she, in fact, was not. So if there is a two hospitalization rule, this record establishes that they do a very poor job of implementing it, because there are a myriad of students who continue and even graduate from the school who return after a second hospitalization. The Milton Hershey School never terminated Abrielle Bartels' enrollment from school. Unfortunately, at the time of her death, they were considering how they would accommodate her disability. And they ultimately elected to do that by allowing her to go on a leave of absence that would permit her to get the mental health services she required. Most of which, again, referring you back to the A130 to 43 reference in the appendix and in this record, established they couldn't even provide under law the level of service that ultimately PPI recommended for her. So they fulfilled that obligation.
All right. Is there any further questions of my colleagues?
No further.
All right. Thank you. We'll hear back from Mr. Cirillo.
You know, I had some prepared remarks, but as I sat there and listened to our conversation, and remember, this is summary judgment, and the only thing we were talking about is genuine issues of material fact. I take issue with a lot of what Mr. Handelman said. If you look at the record, and I'm not going to get into that, but these are the factual issues. Dr. Herr's own testimony, he said, she's likely going to be terminated, or she's going to be, she's going to be terminated or placed on a long-term leave of absence. I'll advocate for a long-term leave of absence, but these are facts we're talking about. He knew that. How did he know that within 24 hours? But we're talking about genuine issues of material fact, and the court punted, and they not only decided issues of material fact, but I say they decided them correctly, either one of which would get us to a jury and a trial. But it's interesting.
Let me ask you this. Even if we conclude that Abrielle was a renter under the FHA, and even if we conclude that the school did owe her a duty that extended beyond the campus, that is while she was hospitalized,
right,
don't you still run into an alternative ground for affirming that you have to establish an element of causation?
I agree with that.
And where is, how would you possibly show that here?
The foremost suicide expert in the country named Dr. Joyner, and what really pushed her over the top was, since I was saying to Judge Beavis, and you picked it up when you were talking to Mr. Handelman, that this was a summer like no others when school year was going to be over. With their facilities, they could have kept her there. She was still an enrolled student. They should have let her go to her graduation party. That pushed her over the top. Dr. Joyner will testify about the causation. Again, these are genuine issues of material fact. We're here on summary judgment. If we lose a trial, we may not be here. But we have the foremost suicide expert in the country who's been deposed by Mr. Handelman that'll testify as to the foreseeable suicide and the causation. And we have that. To answer Judge Bemis's question, I hope that answers your question with the expert testimony.
That's fine.
He wanted me to find something, and I think it was in our reply brief. And I want to make sure I still, when he asked, where would you find that in the record? With the disciplinary, you know, where's your citation? And he said, if you could find the handbook or the enrollment agreement or whatever it was. I think when you read the discipline policy, it's on page 4 of our reply brief, they actually talk about it. In the first paragraph on page 4 of our reply brief, for example, a level 1 violation includes disobeying authority, failure to follow student home rules, a consequence is which extra chores. Chores become a big part of this. One of those rules concerns the chore program. So it gets worse and worse, you get demerit, and you could actually be expelled from the school, and you could lose your housing and your enrollment agreement. One other thing I wanted to say on rebuttal before I close was, I hope that answered Judge Beavis's question, was when I was talking about, and I think I was, it was page about Dr. Herr's, and you picked up on that, Judge Ambrose, within 24 hours of that second admission. These are factual issues that go to a jury, whether we can establish or not. Maybe we lose a trial. That's not why we're here. But what he did, what they did say was, and I took that deposition by videotape, and we intend to play it, is he's about meeting her needs. You would think if when you're there for the first 24 hours, you wouldn't know how much better she's going to be by the 19th. They made a determination early that that's the evidence, that they booted her out and they barred her from campus. You might not know that till the end. Somebody might have a disability. Let's say a pregnant woman, for example, that's no relation to this. She might not be able to do something while she's pregnant, but after she delivers the baby, then she's okay and she can do it. Abby might have been fine and she was discharged by Dr. Syed. We're not saying this is a medical malpractice case. He said there was no reason why, and he actually thought it was better she go back to the Milton Hershey School. But when I asked them, because when I'm going to prove this, you know, they said we couldn't meet her needs. I actually have testimony. I'm going to prove the case through their own witnesses. The last part of when I was talking to Judge Bevis, when I was talking about target goals on page 19 of my brief, I said, if Milton Hershey School was able to meet Abby's high level of mental health need, one of the target goals, yes, yes. I said, was that ever determined? This, and the answer is no. The answer is no. It wasn't determined on the 12th, the 13th, the 14th. I got lucky in that deposition because I knew that it wasn't determined. And I said, was it ever determined? And they said, no. Yet they've been taking the position all along. They couldn't meet her needs. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both. Thank
your time today. And it was my honor and privilege to argue before this Third Circuit. So. I hadn't been in the Third Circuit before. I've been in the Pennsylvania appellate courts, but not the Third Circuit.
We're glad to have you. We kind of ignored the red light, so don't worry about it. Thank you, both counsel, for very well presented arguments, and we'll take the matter under advisement.